The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Riley, Judge Smith, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals by Zoom. Our first case today is O'Neill versus Showalter et al. Court file number is A21-1033. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This Zoom argument is being recorded and will be available tomorrow, but I just wanted to remind everyone, both counsel and anyone who's listening, private recordings either of video or audio manner are strictly prohibited. So with that, the counsel for the appellant, if you're ready, if you could just begin by telling us who you are and in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. James Dickey of the Upper Midwest Law Center on behalf of the appellants, Marion O'Neill and Mark Coran, and may it please the court. In the 40 years before Myron Franz became the Commissioner of Management and Budget, the legislature never approved a state employee collective bargaining agreement. I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I got a notification, I'm sorry. Without a unified bill passed by both houses and signed by the governor. The only time a situation like this arose prior to Commissioner Franz's tenure was in 2001 and 2002, where the House passed an amended version of the Senate bill approving state employee CBAs, which is a flip version of today's dispute. To bridge the differences in the bills, the legislature in that case appointed a conference committee. The commissioner instituted temporary agreements prior to both houses passing a unified bill after the legislative recess. Governor Paul Lenti then signed that bill, and that is how differences are properly solved related to state employee CBAs. Consistently, the Commissioner of Management and Budget admits on his own website that for the entire legislature to agree to any CBA, they must pass the same bill. The commissioner's own document even notes that the governor must sign it, and that document is attached to my affidavit from the district court as Exhibit 7, Document 34 in the record.
In this case, Dickey, has the contingency that the House put in to their approval been met?
You mean the in the Coran amendment in the Senate?
Yes, the Senate. I apologize.
If there had been approval of that same bill by the House, that contingency would have been met, but the House never approved that Senate bill.
My question is not that. My question is there a surplus in the second year as recorded by the omnibus management and budget committee or council or director?
It's my understanding the answer to that question is yes.
Then why isn't this moot?
Because the House never approved that same bill. And so for the entire legislature to act in order for this to have even for that contingency to have become effective and binding in the first place, the House would have actually had to approve that bill. Because you still have basically an inchoate situation where you have neither house, where you had no agreement between the House and Senate on the same issue. Any amendment?
But the House required the amendment that they passed and attached said that if there's a surplus in the second year, they approve that. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And the Senate passed a bill saying they just approve it, correct?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's reversed. The Senate has that amendment that you mentioned. The House approved the bills without any contingency. The Senate provided the contingency, which had the House also agreed on that same contingency, would have been met.
And as I recall, the language from the Senate leadership stated that the salaries have been approved. Is that a fair statement?
I believe Senate President Miller made a statement like that in a public announcement, but I don't think that it would be right to consider his statement binding on the whole Senate.
Why not?
Because he is the Senate President. He's a partisan official. He doesn't have the right to speak for the entire Senate as to what every individual member voted on. His interpretation of it is his interpretation of it. And obviously, Senator Coran would not be in this lawsuit if he had the same view of it. And that's why it's important that this lawsuit go forward and that the court answer whether or not the commissioner has the authority to do what he did. So, but this, in this case, there was no unified bill, Your Honor. There was no agreement on the exact terms of the two bills as one. And as the, as the State versus Naftalin case indicates, an amendment, which the Curran Amendment was to the Senate version of the bill, is a material difference. And that's again, the State versus Naftalin case from our Supreme Court.
And that assumes that under the statute, amendments are permissible.
Well, no, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I believe that even if the statute would have didn't allow amendments, that the Senate and the House could agree to override that. And if the House had agreed to the same language as the Senate, that would have ipso facto resulted in an amendment to the collective bargaining agreements.
But that didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen because there was never an agreement between the two houses, correct? But the reality is, counsel.
My hunch is the Attorney General might have a different view on that subject.
Oh, I'm sure, Your Honor. But in our view, that this case really hinges on the meaning of what it means for the entire legislature to approve a collective bargaining agreement. And that is the language in 3.855. The entire legislature must approve. And the only way, so we believe that that means that the legislature in enacting 3.855 was unambiguously pointing to the Minnesota Constitution and how the legislature acts as a body. It is black letter law that the legislature can only act in its entirety as when it passes a unified bill or resolution or other rule according to the powers granted it by the Minnesota Constitution. There's no evidence anywhere in the statute or anywhere in the Attorney General's argument that indicates that the entire legislature can act in a different way to approve a bill. Your Honor, I'd like to talk about standing for a moment here because that was the basis in which the district court claimed to dismiss this case. This case is
before
easily...
Before you go to that, Mr. Dickey, in your briefing, you did not address the issue of mootness. Is that right?
Your Honor, we in our initial brief, we did not address the issue of mootness. It did not. It was not the reason why the district court dismissed this case. So we didn't address it, really didn't think that it was an applicable argument here because of the fact that there were two different bills that were passed by the House and the Senate. Okay. But we're not, to be clear, we are not waiving our arguments against mootness in this case. And again, as I already mentioned to Judge Connolly, we don't believe that mootness is applicable here.
Did you file a reply brief? Mr. Dickey?
No, we waived the reply brief. As we indicated to the court, we believed it was important for us to get this stuff decided before much more time goes on. And we had moved the court for an expedited appeal and said that we would waive the reply brief. So we wanted to follow through on what we had said we would do. But I
would like to hear more on the issue of mootness, because for me, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I'm not so sure I agree with your interpretation that it's not moot. So would you, your position is simply because even though the contingency has been met, because why again? Because the House didn't accept your amendment, but of course their position is that I assume they didn't have to because it was an either an up or down vote. So I guess I don't know why we would discuss this issue if the contingency that the Senate asked for has been met.
Well, Your Honor, again, the only way that contingency was valid in the first place is if the House had actually agreed on that contingency, and that's what happened.
Are you saying the contingency is not valid at all?
Correct. The contingency is not valid because there was no agreement on that language. In order for the entire legislature to act, in order for that contingency to have been effective, the House would have had to come back and pass the same bill. And again, in 2001...
Well, if the contingency isn't effective, then I guess I'm at a loss to understand how you can complain about anything.
Because there was no...
Are you saying then, is your position then that, contrary to the Senate leader, that these agreements were not approved?
Correct. These agreements were never approved by the entire legislature. Under 3.855, there are three possibilities. One, approval. Two, disapproval. Or three, non-action. Because there was no agreement
does under those three situations, do any of them discuss amendments?
No, no, they don't. The those
so
three situations.
Explain to me why you're allowed to have an amendment then.
Well, whether the Senate was right or wrong to try to make an amendment, if it was wrong to try to make an amendment the same way the House tried to make an amendment in 2002, then there would not have been any agreement in the first place in the same situation. So you have the same situation as 2001 and 2002, and I would encourage the court to go back and look at what exactly happened there. And that is where there was an attempted amendment by the House in that situation. And because there was not a full meeting on the two bills, they went to the legislative coordinating or to a legislative commission, to a committee, and they got an agreement, and then Governor Pawlenty signed the bill. So the legislature recognized in its history in 2001 and 2002 that, in fact, there must be an agreement between the two bills. And so even if you're not allowed to amend, let's say the House was wrong in 2001 and 2002 to try to amend, it doesn't mean that there was automatically agreement to whatever the Senate said. It just means that there wasn't.
But please remind me, when was 3.855 amended to take out so that now it's approve or not approve?
Your Honor, I don't
recall
that.
Took out the modification provision. And when was that amendment?
I don't recall off the top of my head. I know that that was mentioned by the Respondents' Counsel in their brief, but I'd have to refer you to their brief for that timing.
So I think it was after this the 2002 events that you're talking about. I think it was perhaps in response to that.
Your Honor, it might be the case, but I'll assume that that's the case, even though I don't know off the top of my head. But even if I were to assume that that's the case, it would not change the fact that the entire legislature is still required to agree on the language for there to be any passage whatsoever. So if there wasn't an agreement on the entirety of the bill, then again, as State versus Naftalin says, the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that amendments are material differences. And where there are material differences, there is no meeting of the minds. The entire legislature could not act.
Well, Mr. Dickey, I'd like to shift to a separate argument that a counsel for the Attorney General makes, and that's latches. If this was so important, why did you wait several months before you brought this lawsuit? Why didn't you bring this lawsuit the day after you felt that this actions by the commissioner were invalid?
Your Honor, we brought this lawsuit in as expeditiously as we were able under the circumstances of this pandemic that was going on, with our clients having their own other issues going on that they're dealing with at the legislature. We actually provided our clients, made them available, and Representative O'Neill is on here right now as well. And obviously, this is not a testimony taking court, but we made our clients available to testify as to their personal schedules and the and all the different issues that were going on in the state at the time. Sometimes lawsuits take a little bit longer than you would hope to get off the ground. But in this case, we didn't move too slowly. We didn't move slowly enough to that there was an unreasonable delay. And there's no prejudice as a result of this, because as the Supreme Court has, in the Monahan case, has stated, where there are mitigating factors available, whether the commissioner could institute a gap pay measure, for example, latches doesn't lie. And I think
how many months did you wait between the legislature adjourning and bringing this lawsuit?
7 months. It was, I think we filed
and,
this
and
on
during that time period. Were the courts not in session?
They were, Your
I
Honor.
Mean, I guess I'm having a trouble understanding how the pandemic delayed, your bringing of the lawsuit.
Well, it has to do with, I mean, without getting into too much attorney-client communication, there's a lot of discussion.
Well, I'm not asking you to do that. I know. I mean, people can take their time, and that's fine with me. But when they take their time for reasons suiting themselves, I think that sort of begs the question as to, when latches kicks in or not.
So, well, I think could I ask?
You're not asking for reimbursement of monies that have been expended.
No, we actually, we think that the district court made an error in making that statement in that it was just a last minute thing we did at the oral argument. We said in our brief, and we even said in the petition itself, that we were simply seeking a stoppage going forward of the CBAs. And of course, as I mentioned before, and this is why latches again is uniquely inappropriate here, is that the commissioner does have the authority to institute temporary measures to deal with that. And the legislature can act quickly to re-ratify them if that's what they choose to do. The problem here is that they didn't do that.
But doesn't that go to the question of mootness, where you've been operating under a collective bargaining agreement that at least was ratified in some form by both branches of the legislature?
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't think it was ratified in any form, because ratification or approval, as the statute says, requires the agreement of the entire legislature. And I don't think that would go to mootness because, again, it doesn't bear on mootness if the House and Senate decide to get back together and pass a unified bill. That's just the proper procedure for how this should have happened. And that's how it should have happened. And that's how it did happen in 2001 and 2002. I take Judge Connolly's point that the timing of this, it bears on latches, but that does not mean that latches is appropriate. In fact, it's an extreme remedy for the court to go down that road. So I'm out of time right now, and I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal unless the court has more questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dickey. We'll now hear for counsel for the Attorney General, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joe Weiner, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the respondents, Commissioner Showalter, and Minnesota Management and Budget. Your Honors, the respondents request that the court affirm the district court decision dismissing the petition quo warranto. And there are a number of reasons why that dismissal is appropriate. First, the district court correctly held that the petitioners lack standing as either individual legislator or as taxpayers. And what they're seeking here would extend both concepts of standing to improperly encompass an institutional standing of the legislature and provide that right to an individual. Second, there are also other procedural bars to the claims, as this court has identified, including latches and mootness. And finally, substantively, the legislature has ratified the contract, and there has been no appropriation, let alone an illegal appropriation. Section 3.855 sets forth the process for ratification. It's a binary choice. The legislature can accept the agreement or reject the agreement, and they are not allowed to modify the agreement. And ratification and appropriation are two different processes. The appropriation of funds in this case occurred in 2019, and the ratification occurred in 2020. Since Your Honor had some questions about mootness, I did want to touch on that just very briefly. I think it is very clear that the intent from the legislature was to ratify these agreements. The House ratified without a condition, and the Senate ratified, saying that if there was a budget surplus, they would ratify this agreement. Senator Curran stated on the floor, "I believe state employees deserve the raises and benefit increases included in these contracts. If the economy picks up and it restores and puts us back into the positive, the contingency would restore these negotiated agreements." Those are the comments from the petitioner, Senator Curran, here.
And I see that. I also see that in the amendment itself, it says the second year pay raises are not ratified until the commissioner determines that there is a positive budget forecast of general fund revenues. But Mr. Weiner, I was wondering if you could address Mr. Dickey's point in response to my question about mootness. Well, it's not moot because, you know, they didn't, the House didn't adopt the Corn Amendment, or it didn't, I guess the answer is it didn't go back. And then, you know, they both have to agree that the Corn Amendment applies. I was wondering if you could address that, because that's an interesting argument that Mr. Dickey makes.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the basis for that argument is an idea that ratification requires a passage of the bill by both houses, a passage of a bill by both houses, and also a signing by the governor. And what this does is, in fact, imposes an extra textual requirement that's not included in the statute that's at issue in this case. The statute in this case is 3.855, and it says there are two opportunities here. There's approval or disapproval, acceptance or rejection. And as Black's Law Dictionary has identified, an approval, a ratification is an approval that comes after an event. And that's different than the enactment of a law. And the statute itself doesn't say anything about the law. And the only decision that either party has cited that is on point to this, this would be the Phillips decision about the Minnesota Whistleblower Act case. There, this court said nothing in the statutory language of 3.855 suggests that by ratifying contracts, the legislature is enacting a law. And that's not to say that the legislature can't find a way to modify these agreements. They did. I don't think there's any dispute that in 2003, they did modify those agreements. But in that case, what the legislature did is they passed a bill signed by both or passed by both houses that expressly superseded PELRA and Section 3.855 so that they could modify those agreements. And in fact, in this situation, Senator Curran's initial amendment included that same language. They knew how to do that if they wanted to do that. And then they removed that language that would allow them to supersede PELRA and 3.855 and instead put forward the language that we have here, which was simply, if there's a budget surplus, we're going to let folks have these pay raises. And it wasn't just Senator and then Senate President, current Majority Leader Miller. It was Senator Curran on the House floor. It was then Majority Leader Paul Gazelka on the House floor and Senator Benson on the House floor, all of whom said it was very clear that their intent here when they wrote again and again that these contracts are ratified or the contract is ratified, their intent was if there's a surplus, we're going to allow these raises to go into effect. And what that means, Your Honor, is not only was is this case moot currently, the case was moot in November of 2020 before the petitioners even brought their petition to this court. It was moot at the time when they brought this lawsuit, and they knew that it was moot when they did so.
How do you respond to, and here I'm paraphrasing, you know, Mr. Dickey's point, well, you know, Benson and Curran don't speak for the whole legislature, they speak for themselves, and, you know, it's we should look just at the language of the amendment that the Senate adopted.
If the court would like to look at the language that the Senate adopted, I think that's fine. The language says that if there is a budget surplus in November, then at that point, the raises are going to go into effect. And let's be clear, the petitioners have said again and again that they're not seeking to claw back any of the money that was paid. So even if there had theoretically under that idea, if there were a claim that there was some kind of illegal payment between May of 2020 and the budget surplus going into being announced in November, and that should claw back, that's not a claim that they're making. Their claim is simply that going forward, these pay raises and they're not even pay raises anymore. They've been in effect for a year. The Subcommittee on Employment Relations on October 1st approved new agreements, some of which are relevant to this case. And Senator Curran and Representative O'Neill both voted in favor of those agreements with new pay raises for those individuals. So that's yet another idea here that shows that there is no, the case is moot, there has been no injury, everything has moved forward. And it goes to the latches point as well, as Your Honor brought up, which is that this went into effect in May of 2020. And they waited until December of 2020 to bring the petition. They did not ask for any type of expedited relief. They asked for eventually a preliminary injunction hearing that was going to coincide 3 months later with the state defendant's motion to dismiss. And then after the case was decided by the district court, they again waited before seeking review from this court, again, dragging their feet. And it has never been explained, as Your Honor has indicated, that why it is that they've waited so long to bring this claim.
Let me ask this about your latches claim. Did you plead that as an affirmative defense?
Your Honor, we did not plead that as an affirmative defense because we haven't we never actually answered the complaint. We moved to dismiss, and as part of the move to dismiss the petition, we moved at that point for the on the latches argument.
Okay.
I do want to.
I suppose, Mr. Did I pronounce it correctly? It's Mr. Weiner.
Weiner.
Yes, Mr. Weiner. I mean, let me ask you this. What if, let's say, for sake of argument, there wasn't a surplus in this? There wasn't a surplus. I assume your position would be, well, that doesn't matter because they're not allowed to do what they do under 3.855 because they didn't use the PELRA language that they was used in 2002. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, Your Honor. I think we would still claim that as a matter of statutory interpretation. The 3.855 that doesn't allow for any type of modification, that under that basis, there is still the approval that's necessary for the agreement. What it would do is it would negate our mootness argument that would no longer exist, I think is the way that would affect this. I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
Mr. Weiner, I apologize. I did have another question in relating to the latches argument. Would you address Mr. Dickey's point that case law is clear that latches can't be applicable in a situation like this?
I'm not sure that case law is clear that latches can't be applicable in a situation like this. Latches is, I mean, the claim there is, was there an unreasonable delay that prejudiced the respondents? And in this case, I think that's true. The only cases that are cited by petitioners in this case that dispute that are cases that involved somebody taking quick action. And in response to something that occurred. And you've got that in the Arizona case where there was a claim that the law should have been passed or the law as passed should not have gone into effect. And they were continuously having negotiations in an attempt to try to resolve that. What happened here was there were 7 special sessions between May of 2020 and December of 2020. And not once was there any discussion from anybody about these agreements. So it's completely different than the situations where somebody attempted quickly to handle the situation that was in front of them and the concerns that they had. I think it's clear, Your Honor, that this creates a binary choice, the statute, and it doesn't require the passage of a law. And that binary choice is simply approval or disapproval. I don't think there's any dispute that subjects, absent the passing of a new law, they cannot modify the agreement. I know, Judge Riley, you asked when that amendment was passed. The amendment was actually passed in 1979. It was before the 2003 situation. The reason it was passed was in response to the MEA case that petitioners cite throughout their briefing. And the idea there was this would create chaos if we were to allow 201 individual legislators to create the ability to negotiate these contracts. The legislature said, we have one negotiator for purposes of these contracts. That is MMB. And in response to that, we're going to reserve for ourselves the residual power and the residual ability to come forward and say, we approve that agreement or we don't approve that agreement. But we have to do it on an up or down vote. And the question, absent the mootness argument that Judge Connolly that you raised, is what is the effect of the Senate's unlawful condition? I think based on the Senate's the petitioner's argument, it moots the claim. But even if it doesn't, we look at what the senator said, which is this agreement is ratified. They said it 11 times. And then we look at those contemporaneous statements from the leaders. And based on that, it's clear that there has been ratification on this. I don't know if Your Honors would like us to address standing that the court below did. I can say very quickly on that, legislator standing doesn't exist in this situation. This is an institutional injury, not an injury to any individual. And in fact, the petitioner's theory is that the Senate didn't approve this. And if it's the Senate didn't approve this, it is everybody in the Senate who has that injury, not Senator Coran. And so that's the concern there. And on taxpayer standing, what the petitioners are asking is to extend this theory of taxpayer standing to state labor relations, which no court has ever done. And that is because taxpayer standing has been narrowly tailored to the situation in front of it. And here, it would create incredibly bad policy if and upset labor relations. PELRA has a very specific...
You're frozen?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this any better?
Yes. Could you go back 30 seconds and repeat what you were saying? I think most of us missed that. And then I would simply... I'd ask the marshal to stop the clock and put an extra 30 seconds on it because I couldn't hear in the internet. So before we do that, let's kind of get the clock right and hope there's no internet problems. Thank you. Go ahead, okay. Mr. Thompson.
I believe I was talking about legislator standing. And in that situation, the House voted for this. It doesn't matter that Representative O'Neill didn't support that. In the Senate, Senator Coran voted to approve these contracts. And even based on the petitioner's claim here that their claim essentially is that the Senate did not approve these agreements. If that's the case, then that injury is for all of those individuals in the Senate, all 67 of them, and not just one individual. And finally, on taxpayer standing, the court narrowly interprets taxpayer standing to the facts there. And in this case, it would be incredibly bad policy and upset labor relations if the court were to extend this and allow private individuals to force MMB and the state to renegotiate contracts based on taxpayer standing. There is no basis procedurally or substantively for this petition. And it's important to note who's not here today, which is the legislature or even the Senate. The district court correctly found that this attempt to manufacture individual standing out of an institutional harm fails. And Section 3.855 requires legislative approval or disapproval. I see that I'm out of time. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll go ahead and rest.
Thank you. Mr. Dickey, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to address Mr. Weiner's point that, in his words, at least the 3.855 only gives an up or down vote and that we're asking the court to apply extra textual requirements onto the act. And that's not true. What the legislature did in 3.855 was point to the entire legislature having to act. Now, I can find nowhere in the statute or in anywhere else in the Constitution where the entire legislature can act in any way other than by passing a unified bill. The Phillips versus State case didn't say anything about the constitutional manner in which the legislature acts. And so it's unclear from that unpublished and unprecedented decision what exactly was argued before that court. But we think that it's clear that the legislature was pointing to something that would require the entire legislature's action. And in this case, the Minnesota Constitution provides the manner in which the legislature acts. As Mr. Weiner already pointed out, in 1979, Judge Riley, just to confirm, that was when the amendment language was taken out, which lends further credibility to our argument that when the House tried to amend the 2001 and 2002 CBAs, it was still able to do that. And whether or not a previous legislature has made a statement to the effect of this, there's only a couple ways you can do this, subsequent legislatures don't have to use magic language. They can supersede prior existing statutes because no legislature can bind a subsequent legislature. If where we're left at here is if the respondent's argument is to be accepted, then we have a situation where any commissioner can simply read the tea leaves. If the bills do not line up, they can just read the tea leaves and say, well, we think this makes sense, and then apply it. And that would be devastating for the rule of law as it relates to these collective bargaining agreements. I also do want to mention one additional thing related to mootness, since Judge Connolly expressed specific interest in this. One other reason why this case is not moot is because the implementation of these bargaining agreements led to the creation of a baseline on which the future collective bargaining is currently ongoing. So the fact is that there is a live controversy here because the House version of the bill was simply implemented without the Senate's version of the bill being implemented. And again, if there had been an agreement on the Senate language, we'd have a different story, but we don't have that agreement. And we were just stuck reading the tea leaves again. I want to mention standing very quickly here with the time that I have left. Taxpayer standing is used to enjoin the illegal disbursement of funds. There is no dispute in this case that our clients have alleged that there was an illegal disbursement of funds, and there continues to be an illegal disbursement of funds because of the commissioner's actions. That's the end of the taxpayer standing analysis. This case is on all fours with McKee versus Likens, where the taxpayer standing doctrine was originally enunciated by the Minnesota Supreme Court.
And Mr. Dickey, which of the standing arguments do you think is stronger, taxpayer or legislative?
That's a hard question, Your Honor. I think they're both really strong. And I know that's a cop-out, but I think the taxpayer standing argument is the strongest, if only because Senator Curran and Representative O'Neill are admittedly in a different situation as it relates to legislator standing. And I think Senator Curran has a stronger legislator standing argument here. And the reason is, if you look at the Conant case, C-O-N-A-N-T, 603 Northwest 2nd at page 150, the Supreme Court made it really clear exactly when a legislator has standing. And that is when a legislators whose votes would have been sufficient to defeat or enact a specific legislative act have standing to sue if that legislative action goes into effect or does not go into effect on the ground that their votes have been nullified. So Mr. Weiner's concept that this is an institutional injury and because everyone has a right to sue in the Senate, it's just not the case. The reality is that whoever voted to pass the Curran Amendment would have standing to sue if they wanted to as a legislator. In the Conant case, the reason why that case there was no standing for legislators is because the legislators were bringing an institutional injury claim because they didn't have the opportunity to vote. It wasn't because they had a vote that was nullified. So it's a different situation, and this is dealt with on page 23 of our brief. I'll just note, if this is not a legislator standing case, I don't think that there is one that exists. So I don't think that it's appropriate to dismiss on legislator standing, given that the Supreme Court has indicated there are situations in which it would exist, because this is the quintessential case. I'm running out of time here, and Your Honors, again, we'd ask for the court to reverse the district court below and remand for entry of judgment in our favor.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. And